You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's an honor and a privilege to have all of you here and observe our very first Court of Appeals oral argument in this new beautiful Las Vegas courthouse. So I want to welcome all of you, and I thank all of you for coming today. I want to introduce the Court of Appeals. To my right is Judge Jerome Tao. To my left is Judge Michael Gibbons. Judge Tao had been an 8th Judicial District Court judge here in Las Vegas with me, and Judge Gibbons, 9th. I knew that. 9th. He's from Minden, Nevada, and he still resides up in Minden. So his home base is out of Carson City. So it's a pleasure to have him here as well today. Today we have one case on our docket, which is Looney versus Looney. It's a consolidated case. It's case number C4582. And it is consolidated with case 64985. I'm going to ask the parties before you begin to argue, make sure you state your name for the record for our court clerk. And also, I'll ask the appellant at this time whether or not she needs extra time for rebuttal argument. And how much time would you need? You don't need to stand if, I see you're on crutches, and you don't need to stand if that's easier for you. Whatever is good for you. How many minutes would you need for rebuttal? 10 minutes for rebuttal? Okay, fine. I was just wondering, because each side gets 15. So we'll give you 5 minutes of rebuttal time. And again, thank you all for coming here at this time. We'll begin oral argument whenever you're ready. Thank you, Ms. Parr. Also, make sure you introduce, I see you have probably a client here. Is that a client or an associate?
This is my sister, Barbara Rhodes.
Okay.
Much needed today.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Moore, appearing on behalf of appellant Trent Looney. This appeal follows the district court's order. Specifically, there are three main issues in the appeal. First and foremost is the district court's denial of a modification of Mr. Looney's appellant's support obligations, child support, and alimony. And in that regard, they were denied initially in July, with a motion for reconsideration filed in July of 2013, and that was based on the court's denial after Mr. Looney had lost his employment. He was terminated from his former employer, 3M. And the district court said, well, you can come back in 4 months. And at that time, his child support and alimony obligations were approximately $3,400 a month, and his income was zero. The court denied the motion for reconsideration, and ultimately the matter was heard at the time of trial. At the time of trial, the evidence we referred in our opening brief and our reply brief, the evidence was that Mr. Looney was earning at that time half of what his income had been at the time the support obligations were stipulated to. It was a stipulated decree of divorce. And the court, there wasn't any basis, let alone a substantial basis, to deny that. And in fact, the court said,
the standard review on what the district court did here for us is abuse of discretion. And the district court's order specifically says that he finds Mr. Looney's testimony to not be credible. And as you know, questions of credibility are classically for the district court because we don't get to see the testimony. We have at best, you know, the transcript. And as you know, that tells you sometimes you can't see body language, demeanor, any of that stuff. So how do you expect us to sort of revisit that question?
I certainly understand that. And that is the authority that that we base the standard of proof for an appeal. But I think the court has to look at the record. There's a letter from his employer stating that he's terminated, he no longer works there. It was completely disregarded by the trial court. Completely disregarded. And I understand, and particularly in family court, sometimes emotions run high, and sometimes there unfortunately are certain prejudices towards one party or the other, but that certainly doesn't permit the court to just throw out the law. We apply the facts to the law, and in this case, the court completely disregarded the facts.
Well, what authority do you have to support that an evidentiary hearing is mandated in an issue of necessary, what your motion was in the third order?
In the third order?
Right.
Well, there wasn't.
Because you wanted to have a hearing, obviously, to go over why he wasn't able to produce the documents by the time period that she had held on to them. What authority do you have that says that a district court must have an evidentiary hearing for something like that?
Well, and certainly that's the discretion of the court, but I would note for this court that, and that's in our opening brief and our reply brief, when presented with that, specifically the respondent waited until September 1st, well after the time, the 14-day time period had lapsed, to provide the box of documents to the appellant, and there was never a denial. As a matter of fact, there was silence.
Well, to justify an evidentiary hearing, you have to make a prima facie showing that you're at least plausibly entitled to some relief, and then, before the judge even hears from the other side. And in looking at the record, it looks like you didn't actually attach the documents that your client says he found to the motion. And the only thing that I could see attached to the motion is literally a half-page affidavit without the documents. So if you're the district judge, someone files a motion and says, I want an evidentiary hearing, a bunch of documents that I'm not giving them to you, just trust me, they're there. Why wouldn't the district judge be fully justified in saying, look, this is not even a complete motion, how can I grant it?
Well, I understand, and at that time, it was my understanding that the documents, I believe at the time that we filed, they were not ready to be attached. But in any event, and I'm glad that the court brought that up, his declaration is evidence in and of itself. It's sworn testimony under oath that this is what happened. That, coupled with the complete silence from the respondent, nothing.
Well, but for fraud in the court, there's two elements. One is that there was some kind of concealment, which, even if you, let's even say that he's established that, but the second element, and I'm going to put this very colloquially, it would have made a difference. And the affidavit doesn't say to what happened before, and the affidavit doesn't touch on that. It just says, I found these documents, and I believe these documents to be true. But where's the second element, which is these documents are actually relevant to something in the case?
Well, with all due respect, the record is amply contains, time and time again, his argument, even at evidentiary hearing, at the settlement conference, which preceded everything, kept saying, I need the documents. He brought into this marriage, it was approximately $75,000 in separate funds, and all she had to do, she had exclusive possession of the marital residence, and conveniently, she hands the minor child a box full of the documents that he needed for tracing. And sadly, one would think that you would be able to trace those regardless, but there had been, the one company went out of business, that was a nightmare, account numbers were changed, so it was virtually impossible.
But didn't you roll that money over in 2007, and that's clearly during the marriage, and you rolled it into yet another community, so to speak, fund. He's commingling it anyway.
That typically we go based upon the time rule and the quadro, so despite, because otherwise that would entail, and I appreciate that, but otherwise that would entail somebody, when they get married, having to apportion out their separate property and put it somewhere else, and there'd be tax consequences potentially with that, as well as other things I'm probably not even addressing. So that's where the quadro is typically performed, so that there's an apportionment of the separate property from the community property.
Ms. Moore, if you go back to that settlement conference you were referencing, it says specifically, if he can provide proof within 14 days that it's a separate property source, he will be entitled to that money, and that'll be separated from the retirement. So that was a given, but he didn't provide it in 14 days, and there weren't any conditions put on that 14 days, as such as if I can get the documents, or if my wife will give them to me. I mean, 14 days is a really short time. That implies to me that he already had the documents.
And not only that, but remember, this isn't a court deadline. It's a negotiated deadline. He agreed to it.
It was, and I was not at the settlement conference. I came onto the case much later, and I agree a well-written settlement would have had contingencies in that case, so that in 14 days, I'm glad the court brought that up too, it's virtually impossible. Anybody that's dealt with, you know, trying to get through the red tape, so to speak, it's a daunting task at best.
I mean, it's pretty common that one side leaves the house and the documents are at the house and the other party's there. There's going to be a problem. I mean, this happens all the time in divorces.
And that's one of the reasons I'm standing here today. Unfortunately, it's sad, but that area of law is very emotional, and it's emotion-driven for the most part. And things, that's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to...
When you finally got to the hearing on the 60B motion to set aside the judgment, the judge asked about the documents, and you said, I have it here, I got it yesterday. What? And he wouldn't allow you to admit it into evidence.
No.
What was that? I mean, was there some way to make that part of the record so it could show that it was separate property?
Unfortunately, no. The judge was not inclined. And if the court recalls, this court, or the Nevada Supreme Court, issued a writ of mandamus because the district court had wrongly issued an order for the incarceration of Mr. Looney for 375 days, which this court...
He filed something just to make a record of what that was.
Well, the court wasn't... The court, in hindsight, perhaps, but the court... I can't guess what the court would have done, but at that point, it was very obvious.
At the clerk's office. I mean, you could have left... it happens in civil criminal as well, where somebody wants to make a record and the judge wants to move on, and they don't allow a party to do that, but that party walks out of the courtroom, goes back to the office, and files something, e-files it, and there's a record, no matter what, in that case, of what they wanted to make a record of.
Sure. And strategically speaking, a better course was determined to be an appeal to this court based upon its former issuance of the writ of mandamus and to seek relief from this court.
Speaking of appeals, another question I had was, you didn't appeal for your client the August order. That was not appealed. The only thing you appealed was the reconsideration of the August order. By what means or vehicle law is that separately appealable? I'm going to give you more time.
Just
the reconsideration.
Oh, the reconsideration. I was not attorney of record then. Mr. Looney came to me immediately prior to facing that continued incarceration, which coincidentally, it was astounding that when we did return to court after the issuance of the writ of mandamus, and this is in our brief too, in our recovery, the district court said it never intended to implement the incarceration. So it made an order that it didn't intend on anybody following, which I'm at a loss, but in any event, I would submit to the court that based on the contentious and contentious nature of the hearing and the what it appears to be prejudicial rulings against Mr. Looney, that this case is ripe for remand so we can get it right.
Thank you.
One last question going back to the documents, because we've talked about the documents aren't in the record, but they weren't attached to the motions, nobody's seen them, so you have the notice problem, but there's a second layer problem here. How are you going to authenticate them?
Well, we would have to go to great lengths to do that, but I'm confident when there's a will, there's a way. But having the documents was the main...
That goes back to my question, and I think you probably see where I'm going with this. That's the problem of showing up at a hearing with a box of documents and just waving around, is the district court's entitled to not even look at them because they're not admissible yet. They haven't been admitted yet. So, given the state of affairs on the date of the hearing, where you're in the situation you're in, I know that you want counsel record, so when I say you, I don't mean you individually.
No, I understand.
But that's the problem just showing up, is you can't just show up with documents. The documents have to be authenticated in some way, affidavit or testimony or custodian records affidavit or something along those lines.
Certainly. I would do everything within my power to make that happen, and if it didn't, then that would certainly be an issue for the court. As far as how it would view the credibility of the documents. what Mr. Looney has said from day one, even at the settlement conference. And again, I wasn't there, but it's unfortunate that sometimes all contingencies aren't planned for. Sometimes when you live with somebody for so many years and you share a life together and children, you don't think that another party is going to act that way. It happens. It's unfortunate, but it happens. But the question for the court is, do we stand idly by and let that happen based on technicality of a poorly drafted settlement agreement?
Thank you, Ms. Marr. I'm going to give you another minute on the clock for your rebuttal. We'll give it up to, how about 3 minutes and 30 seconds?
Okay.
We've gone way over. Thank you.
That's a good number.
Thank you. I heard from respondent once she's made her way back.
Good morning. It's a privilege to be here. My name is Max Cuvier, Black and Labello. I'm in conjunction with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I am representing today the respondent, Jana Looney. I thank you for your time. I'm going to address some of the questions that you were asking my colleague here first, and then I assume the court doesn't have questions, or if it does, welcome to interrupt me, regarding the showing of changing circumstances. Because the questions really, and the issue directed towards the box and the retirement account, go towards the second issue on appeal, which is the documents in the retirement account. And as the court aptly noted, the divorce decree, which was negotiated with counsel, with the appellant, who is a sophisticated businessman, who had an opportunity to review it, read it, obtain a notarization on it. That divorce decree acknowledges that prior to the divorce decree, the appellant had opportunity to obtain the records and obtain information regarding his claim for a separate account. And he was not able to obtain that. And I direct the court to the record at ROA 0025-26. The divorce decree, again, negotiated and jointly prepared by the appellant, says, defendant has asserted a separate property claim to the retirement account maintained in his name based upon his employment with 3M. Having produced no documentation to substantiate or produce such claims during the litigation of this matter. Acknowledges. And so then he goes on, and the divorce decree gives himself a second bite at the apple and negotiates, again, with his attorney, that they would have 14 days to produce the documents from February 22nd, 2013. With the aid of counsel, a sophisticated appellant believed that 14 days was sufficient time to do that. But he did not meet his obligation. And here's what the record shows.
Mr. Kirby, hold on a second. I don't think there's any dispute about this, that Mr. Looney was wrong, he was neglectful, he didn't do what he was supposed to do. But we're talking about Rule 60B, which recognizes that excusable neglect allows a court to set it aside. So you walk in the door knowing there's neglect. The question is whether it's excusable neglect. He never got a chance to present it because the judge wouldn't let him talk at the hearing. No testimony was allowed. And there was no opposition ever filed either in writing or verbally.
And Your Honor, that's a good question, because the court has discretion when you're talking about a motion for reconsideration. And
in this case, not the reconsideration, the Rule 60B motion.
And the court examining and having dealt with this issue dealt with it appropriately. The reason being, Your Honor, is because it was appellant's obligation to produce those documents. And there is, on the record, absolutely no evidence that he asked 3M for those documents in February, March, April, May, or June of 2000.
He was very neglectful, extremely neglectful.
And he admits in his affidavit, which is ROA 0086 at lines 20-26, that he could have subpoenaed the records. But more tellingly, Your Honor, is that there is a letter from 3M, and that is on the record at ROA 0097. It's a letter dated July 31st, 2013.
You have all the facts in your favor, but the district court made no findings that his neglect was not excused. The judge simply said, to paraphrase, he lied about this in the past, he's probably lying now, I'm not even going to look at it.
The court can't consider the credibility of the parties. The court can't consider past evidence. During the four-day evidentiary hearing, which the court dealt with most of these issues, the court found, and the record demonstrates, time and again, manipulation of evidence, fraudulent testimony, misrepresentation, and, in fact, on the issue regarding the 3M accounts, when the appellant was asked about those, because they demonstrated that he had wrongfully removed monies contrary to a divorce decree, the court found, and when those documents were presented and shown to the appellant, that the appellant, in the face of the court, denied their credibility.
So when he removed certain monies from that, he certainly had the account number right before the settlement conference to remove money from there. So he must have had the account numbers. Is that what you're saying?
He absolutely had.
He removed them in January, right?
You're talking about 3M right now, aren't you? This is a separate property of the company you worked for before 3M, and that's why we couldn't get those documents.
Well, but again, the letter at ROA, there is a letter from 3M. The response to appellant's attorney. Appellant's attorney, it said, Your Honor,
he had the account number of 3M in order to get all of the documents from 3M. Is that what you're saying? Which would have then shown that in 2007 he had put monies in there from somewhere.
He didn't want those records produced because they showed that he was in contempt of the divorce decree, that he had misrepresented it, that he had removed money from that account, which is one of the third issues here, that he wants to stick it to her to pay the taxes on the amount he wrongfully removed from their retirement account. But he didn't want those records. Again, I point, there's a letter from his appellant to 3M on July 29, 2013. 3M is responding on July 31st, just 2 days later. It said, Counsel, thank you for your request of July 29th regarding information about appellant's account. Here it is. Just took him 2 days. 2 days to respond to that.
So that's contrary to him saying that he couldn't subpoena those records.
Absolutely. And no, he actually understood he could subpoena those records. But there's nothing on the record that is presented to this court that says, well, how did the court abuse its discretion? Because all the court and the record here demonstrates was a person coming to the court that lacks credibility and has the multiple bad findings against that person saying, well, I couldn't get that information. And you know what? Let's shift the blame. And it really happened to be because the respondent had it in a box. She didn't know she had a box. If she didn't want to produce those documents, would have never appeared. Right? But as it happens, people leave boxes behind. People find them. She called them, have the box, come pick it up. And now suddenly manufactured this issue. But that's not the point. She had the obligation to prove
it. Mr. Kirby, I agree with you. If she had said that, the judge could have made a factual finding. I believe her, not him. But there's nothing in the record giving her side of the story about why these documents suddenly appeared. Did she withhold them? Why did she have them? There may be a very innocent explanation, but right now there's zero in the record.
Well, if I can jump in, maybe this is the answer to the question. As far as the record is concerned, I'm not talking, you know, obviously we can't see what happened, you know, down in the district court, but as far as the record that we have is concerned, right? And this goes back to the question of the records are not in the document, the documents that we're talking about are not in the record, weren't filed with the district court. How do we even know the documents exist? The only evidence that we have the documents even exist is his affidavit saying I got a bunch of documents and I'm not attaching them. So how do we even actually know, for purposes of the record that we have now, that there are any documents?
That's absolutely correct. We don't know that. And it was his burden to show the separate property. And it was his burden to come up with it.
We don't have the documents, but we do, as Ms. Marr pointed out, have his sworn declaration that's unopposed. So there's something in the the record, but why don't we have anything from Ms. Looney?
Sure, Your Honor, because this really wasn't obligated to come forward with that information, Your Honor.
Even when a motion's filed?
Your Honor, at that point, Ms. Looney, as you can see, has gone through separate different counsel, Your Honor, not here pro bono, okay?
She has the same problem as Mark has today.
No, Your Honor.
Actually, yours is worse than yours.
Absolutely. The respondent, I'd like to hit the other point, is in contempt. He owes, the appellant owes the respondent $163,000 that the remaining half of the retirement account has not been turned over. There is no stay on the record issued from this court, the Nevada Supreme Court, or the district court. A person must, this is black letter law, comply with an order until that order has been found to be void or on appeal or stayed.
Sounds like there's going to be another contempt motion.
And maybe this time the district court might actually appoint counsel or have counsel to which, be careful what you wish for, right? Because you may get 375 days in jail.
The other point,
when it's done right.
One can't stand in contempt, thumbing their nose at the judicial system, asking for relief.
Right. But do you take the position if somebody has lied once, they're always the liar, and therefore the judge, he might as well not even show up because it doesn't matter what he says?
Well, Your Honor, the failure to file an opposition doesn't say, it does not indicate under the rules that the opposition, that the court must grant, believe, or do anything otherwise. The district court always retains discretion. And in this case, Your Honor, I submit that the record, what we have here on appeal, demonstrates amply, time and again, evidence, tampering, misrepresentations, contempt. Right? You have a person that is supposed to meet their burden. And when the court said, produce documents, because we have to go back to Judge Hardcastle. She took a look at it in July. And she said, you're playing games with your retirement account. So this isn't just one district court judge's perspective. This is a secondary district court judge's perspective. And so you're coming in and you are exercising your discretion, and the person is given time and again opportunities to comply with a negotiated settlement that he negotiated with his attorney and has failed time and again. The court was well within discretion not to entertain a sideshow circus, putting my client, the respondent, under the gun when it wasn't her burden.
The judge had just given a couple minutes to that, though, we wouldn't be here on this issue.
I believe that the court's January 3rd, 2014 order in which he gave the defendant 4 days of evidentiary hearings, in which those documents, again, they came up, they were there, and he disowned them.
If the only evidence that we even have that the documents exist is the appellant's affidavit, when the district judge says, I find you not credible, couldn't we construe that as saying, I don't believe there are any documents because, number one, you're not credible, number two, you haven't shown them to me? Is that a fair construction of what the district court said?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the same issue with changing circumstances. Again, there's no financial evidence that substantiates it. And when the court, 4 days of evidentiary hearing, asked for the change in circumstances to change the payment obligations, what was produced? What's on the record before you that demonstrates that he had a change in circumstances? Again, as the court has noticed, all we have is self-serving testimony, which the court has already found to be not credible, which I agree wholeheartedly. And in finding that, the court found necessarily that it doesn't exist. Doesn't exist. This person, the appellant, has had his fair shake. He's had his opportunity to produce. Time and again, he has failed.
But that was the four-day hearing. The 60B motion pertains to the later hearing, and there was no testimony offered at all. Mr. Looney wanted to testify. The judge said no. Mr. Looney, through Ms. Marr, offered the exhibit that wasn't previously submitted. She said, I just got it yesterday. Judge said, no, you can't even submit that. I've never even heard of that before, where a judge said you can't even have a document marked and made part of a record.
And when it comes to fraud, I think part of the other allegation that the appellant was making was that she frauded him. She kept that box. She knew that she had 2 weeks, and by virtue of time, she got way more out of that retirement account than had she produced the documents early. So the allegation is also fraud, again, 60B, with no evidence being taken. When you look at most of the Supreme Court law, including a more recent case, even in the foreclosure cases, which I know you're probably, you know, more, you know, I know you're doing this pro bono in the family, but the Supreme Court wants evidentiary hearings taken when it comes to fraud allegations.
And that's a good point.
Shadowwood.
But by this point, you don't have an overwhelming record in those cases of fraud and manipulation of the system. You don't have a case where time and again documents are produced, and then when they're produced, they're disavowed, or that they're not produced, or that they're not asked for. And the court was well within its discretion, having had the intimate, face-to-face, gone over 4 days of evidentiary hearing and multiple hearings, where evidence was presented, where evidence was discounted, where the respondent was combative, elusive. The court was well within discretion at that point to have made the ample recognition that whatever was coming, he could judge based upon what he had already seen.
Thank you so much. And we'll hear back from the appellant.
The court hit the nail on the head when it said that Mr. Looney wasn't allowed to simply produce any evidence, and that this court...
Let me ask you this, all right? This is a Rule 60 motion. Is there any other type of motion anywhere in the Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 12, Rule 56, Rule 50, judgment of matter law, where you cannot attach exhibits to your motion and then show up at the hearing and just say, I want these added to my motion without notice? Is there any other motion anywhere in the rules that lets you do that?
I'm not aware of any. That's why, given the short amount of time that we had in which to file the motion and get some type of relief.
You couldn't continue the motion and try to file a supplement?
The court wouldn't even hear what we tried to do.
No, before the oral argument. You couldn't file a stipulation between the hearing date so you can file a supplement? I mean, this is the question. A motion, right? By definition, a motion, if you want to win, has to be self-contained. You can't just file half a motion and then show up at oral argument and say, here's the other half, didn't serve it on the other side, no one's seen this before, the judge has never seen it before, I want you to look at them right now and we're on the spot.
Fair enough.
Any other motion that you can do that in?
Fair enough. I'm unaware of any. However, I think the court understands that this judge wasn't going to allow Mr. Looney to do anything, and it would have been fruitless to try to put anything before this court. That's why, you know, we put the affidavit given the brief amount of time, and we appealed to this court for relief because it was very obvious that we weren't going, or my client wasn't going to get a fair shake, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I know that's your position, but the judge doesn't have to do something that's outside of the rules, right?
Correct. No, correct. But he wasn't even willing to hear testimony. He wasn't willing to do anything. And I think this court needs to maybe be reminded that we're not dealing with a pauper for an ex-wife here. She blew through $124,000 that had been paid from community funds to her, refused to go get a job.
Well, we don't care about the facts. Okay? We don't relitigate the facts here.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a question on the law, though,
sure.
Which has to do, again, though, with the fraud. With the Rule 60 motion. The Nevada Supreme Court has also stated that when it comes to fraud upon the court motions, that all the court needs to have is a proper hearing. We don't even need an evidentiary hearing. So I'm posing to you, if you don't even need an evidentiary hearing in civil cases on fraud upon the court, why here when your client has already been established, at least by this trial court, the trial court said he lied in a written order, which is pretty strong. Why should a district court, why is that abuse of discretion in this particular case under Rule 60?
Under Rule 60, I think we need to deal with each issue separately, and because we deem somebody to unfairly be a liar. And I'd like to remind the court also that Mr. Looney, while he may be an astute businessman, he's not a lawyer. He tried to play a lawyer. It didn't work well for him during the evidentiary hearing. He actually did jail time until this court issued its writ of mandamus. But it did not work well for him, and lost my train of thought.
Sorry. We were talking about fraud upon the court. The Supreme Court has talked about a proper hearing and not really told us what is a proper hearing, and that's fraud upon the court. Here we're talking about it could be a fraud, it could be fraud on the other party, it could be an excusable neglect, and all the Supreme Court in those particular cases have talked about a proper hearing and not really gone into it. Renata denial has not necessarily reversed, to my knowledge, any district court judge for no evidentiary hearing.
And I would submit to the court that it's time for such a decision, because, and I'm glad the court brought that up, because not only was it a fraud upon my client, withholding, concealing that information, that tracing information, because it was from not 3M, but from a former employer, and that's why the account numbers were critical, but it's also a fraud upon the court, and it should not stand. And I'd like to, if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'd just like to
follow up to your question.
I guess we have more questions. We're a hot bench. This is a court of appeals. We ask a lot of questions.
Right.
Ms. Marr, this is actually a very important distinction, whether your claim is a fraud upon the court versus a claim of excusable neglect. I read your motion. I read it as excusable neglect caused by fraudulent activity from a third party, meaning the ex-wife. And therefore, your claim was excusable neglect, and you wanted an evidentiary hearing to explain why this was delayed, not fraud upon the court when the normal time period of 6 months doesn't apply anymore. You were within 6 months, so it was the usual excusable neglect type of claim. Did I read that wrong?
No, he didn't. It is excusable neglect because somebody was concealing the documents from him. But since the court brought it up, in the big picture, when one party does something like that, which again, sadly, it's typical in a family court arena, it's a fraud upon everyone, including the court.
But wait, so what is your motion? Is it excusable neglect under 60B, I think it's 2, or is it fraud on the court under 60B, I think it's, I might be getting the numbers wrong, but which is it? You can't just say it's excusable neglect, yes it is, Judge Gibbons, and by the way, it's fraud on the court. What is your motion?
It's 60B, and it's perpetrated. The reason it's excusable neglect is the fraud of the respondent. She concealed these documents.
So if it's not an actual fraud on the court allegation, then Chief Judge Silver's question about the hearing isn't actually even a thing here, because we're not talking about fraud on the court. You're saying that there was an underlying fraud, but that's not your motion. Your motion is an excusable neglect motion.
I'm thinking outside of the box, and I'm thinking, you know, that globally when somebody commits an act like that, it's just like somebody commits an act, a criminal act, against an innocent third party. It's actually an act against the entire community, isn't it? Because it affects the safety of our community. The same thing in this case. He had an excuse for not producing the documents based upon her fraud, specifically her concealment. And then later she was silent regarding that concealment, as this court's already noted. But it is a fraud upon everybody, not just him. So the motion was geared towards, we want to give him a chance to present the documents and go through and explain the numerations and the calculations. This is how he came up with this number. This is how he came up with that number. But essentially, it is a fraud upon all of us. That somebody can come into a court of law, withhold the box, which is, unfortunately, as I said before, it's not uncommon in a family court arena for parties, grown adults, to act like that, and it serves no purpose other than to harm each other for unchecked emotions that they can't get past.
Maybe you're not understanding my question. Fraud on the court under 60B, whatever the number is, maybe 3 or 4, whatever it is, has elements to it, okay?
Yes.
If it's a fraud on the court motion, then we apply those elements. If it's an excusable neglect motion, then we apply an entirely different set of elements to it. So the question is, which set of elements are you asking us to apply?
The excusable neglect, but if the court is so inclined, based upon the testimony here today, or the argument rather, then I would welcome the court to categorize it if it sees differently, based upon the argument and the pleadings that have been submitted to the court.
Thank you so much. Okay.
I just wanted to get back to the child support issue, the support issue.
I think your time's up. Okay. We'd let you have a lot more time, but thank you so much.
All right. I just wanted to read for the court to one of the exhibits and the record. But
thank you.
Robert.
All right. This now stands submitted with the Court of Appeals. And again, we want to thank all the visitors and thank the parties and the attorneys in this case. And, of course, pro bono, too, for coming and doing this. And would either of my brethren like to say anything to the public?
I just want to thank you all for taking this case pro bono. As you guys know, there's lots of litigants out there who can't get assistance counsel for whatever reason, and we really appreciate when, especially experienced attorneys, I know we're probably outside of your field of practice, but your years of expertise, are of great assistance to the parties, and we really do appreciate that, and hope that everybody here who's an attorney will take some pro bono cases in the future as well.
And both attorneys did a really good job. Thank you. And Mr. Cuvier, as you said, you did come into this case even later than Ms. Marr. But that didn't stop you from searching the record and finding that you obviously knew the record very well. And it's much appreciated that you put that kind of effort into it.
And we recognize it's a more difficult case with various judges and different attorneys. So you did a great job. Both sides did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Marr, is family law your normal area of practice or no? Is family law your normal area of practice?
For some reason, I do quite a bit of it recently.
Okay.
I just can't say no.
I bet this courtroom feels a little different than the family court, though.
It does.
How does it feel? It's pretty nice.
Much better. we're off the record, right?
No, we're not. You can talk freely, though.